Hello, everybody, and I hope I'm doing this correctly. I think so. So far, it seems correct. Well, friends, I'm continuing. I hope you can get this horrible abbreviation that I've come up with. DINA, Discipleship in the New Age, version one, section one. And I think we're still in part three, video commentary. So it will be a short program, I think, because, well, I have a treatise on cosmic fire continuing. I call it cosmic fire in depth, but what can I say? What is depth? Depth is what the Tibetan knows of it, and kind of a superficial skittering over the surface of the water is what we are capable of. We're skittering on the great, on the surface of the great ocean of theosophy. Let's see what it says here. That's all my favorite words, dire distress. I'll just use a little segue from where we have been before. Yet at the heart of every nation lies latent the mystical soul. And eventually, and here we go, after dire struggle and distress, and why should it be, let me ask, why should it be any different for the individual human being that it is for the nation? After dire struggle and distress, all will be well. I like those words. Maybe you do too. There will always be a resolution. I really realize my image is a bit darkened here. I haven't turned on so many lights, but probably at least you'll know I'm present with you. Then he goes on and says, tendencies towards materialism, towards personality achievement must, under the larger plan and the will to good, let me say, not just our little plan and our microcosmic will to good, but the larger plan and the will to good, must be offset by a counter move of spiritual living. And let me say, spiritual knowledge is one thing, even if it's reasonably complete, and spiritual living is a whole other thing, because it represents the capacity to make the outer world conform to the inner growing spiritual realization. I think I know I need that, and I'm sure there are people, maybe some among you, who need that as well. So we ended program 10, and I don't know what day it was. It says, gosh, I'm not sure. Maybe it was the 9th, Wasn't yesterday. I didn't do so well yesterday. Maybe good old Bastille Day, when the prisoners are let out of the great jail in France as part of the French Revolution. But now it's the 16th, and we're beginning program 11. And as I said, we're still in section 3, I do believe. You know, I'm kind of going on ahead here. And I'm sure before long we'll come to something, although this is lengthy, to a kind of section 4, but goodness, we have a lot of material to cover apparently in section 3. And the Tibetan is giving us things in outline form, so meticulously conceived, so meticulously organizedly conceived. You know, there we go, part 4. Well, let me just at least make that as if it looks like something. And so we have a long way to go before we get to part 4. And as I said, you know, I won't be using the old method of underlining so many things and making words bigger, and it just takes too much out of me and delays the time that I could be spending helping to explain things to the degree I can. So, gosh, I wonder if I could just hold on for a second. Okay, I'm just trying to get a little more light on the subject, and pretty soon that will be the case. So anyway, DK goes on and says, let such working disciples, let me say, those are the operative words, working disciples, that's the only real kind anyway, see to it, therefore, that their love for all beings, not, may I say, not just the human being, but many beings, so they begin to get the idea that love is something different than when channeled through the solar plexus center, or channeled apparently through the sacral center. So that their love for all beings deepens, and that the growth of their love comes through their tapping the group love, which lies back of all world happenings. Let me say, as it is said, the love which underlies the happenings of the times. So, you know, behind it all is this incredible love, no matter what it seems to put us through. And maybe the closer we are to the great love, the more exacting and onerous seem to be our life events. So the Tibetan goes on, my brothers, when will the time come when the world will realize that the love aspect of the logos, may I say the solar logos, I think, as it affects the human kingdom, and may I say, on a number of different planets, because each planet has its humanity. It is, after all, a stage. Okay, so now my dear daughter who's visiting me has helped to turn up a little bit of light so we can better see. So again, my brothers, when will the time come? He's addressing us, right? When the world will realize that the love aspect of the Logos, our soul, the Logos, our great, the great heart center of a cosmic Logos of seven major suns, that the love aspect of the Logos as it affects the human kingdom is focused through the inner subjective group of workers. You know, we don't really work this up from below. We, in fact, work it down from above. And may I say, we have no idea what is the love that the great head of hierarchy, the Christ, is experiencing. It's always out of reach, not conceptually, and we climb slowly the ladder of evolution until we come closer and closer, one rung or one point of tension after another, to begin to experience what the Christ is always experiencing. And of course, any great worker like he is would have his moments of supreme intensity and lesser moments, but those all moments are filled with the power of love and identification. The Tibetan goes on, that love is now in the stage of anchoring itself physically through the new group of world servers, such as this group. He's considering all the people that he has attracted and to whom he is offering opportunity. So that love is anchoring itself physically through the new group, I think it's the world servers, which are in process of forming all over the world. And let me say that by saying that, he decentralizes us, so we don't think of ourselves as particularly special, as that is a dangerous conclusion. So much is going on about which we have truly no idea. These new groups are centers, or should be, of divine love, magnetic, constructive, and pure. Well, you know, Master DK's ashram, which will be one of the initially externalizing ashrams, we are told, I think it's in externalization of the hierarchy, carries the energy of right human relations, which of course are based upon love divine, which itself is based upon the still higher will to good. So we can know all kinds of things or convince ourselves that we have the book learning regarding all kinds of things, but do we have actually the simple experience of divine love as it relates to what he says, all beings? Sounds very Buddhist too, doesn't it? You know, may there be, I'll paraphrase, but release or compassion for all sentient beings, but is there such a being that is not sentient? So therefore all beings. So we are joining groups where divine love, magnetic attractive, right? Constructive according to the divine plan and pure without mixed motives. I once had a friend, still have a friend, who accused me of mixed motives. Of course, I protested, but it's almost impossible at our particular stage not to have mixed motives, some of which still are aimed at the aggrandizement of the personality. Magnetic, constructive, and pure. Okay. Makes me want to, you know, I'm just outlining a few things. So DK goes on, you know, you can distinguish, right, between what I'm saying, between the lines, between the sentences, and what he is saying. I'm just doing a little connecting and elaborating, trying to draw the sphere of knowledge a little tighter, a little more into an integrated condition. Imagine having, as Master DK has, a truly integrated sphere of knowledge. And divine love really working in our consciousness so that we would then have, as it is said, the mind as it is in Christ. So he goes on. See to it, therefore, that your conformity, there's a good old Saturn, that your conformity to the requirement is met in the measure of your physical strength. Well, we do have to have that outer instrument, don't we? And it has to hold us up, prop us up in this world, this conditioned world, which is not yet a perfect reflection of the archetypal world. You know, the conditioning is Saturnian, the archetypal world is Uranian, even if we simply compare the dense physical body and the etheric body. Right there, we see the dramatic outworking between Saturn, the physical body, and under Ray 3 generically, and then Uranus ruling the planetary ethers, even as it rules the cosmic ethers. As long as I'm on a little tangent here, obviously, it's Saturn that rules the lower 18 subplanes. Then there's the transitional 3 subplanes, where Venus is very important. Then another 28 subplanes on our cosmic physical plane, and they are called the cosmic ethers, and they are Uranian and not Saturnian, although, well, not to diverge too much, but that Saturn is the, as it were, permanent atom of the etheric, physical, cosmic etheric physical plane. So, when DK says, see to it, he means business, of course. You know, he sets the standard by which we progress. And in turning on the original sound, I don't know whether that will be helpful. Perhaps you might hear a little bit of a fountain in the background. See to it, he says. Or sometimes, see you to it. Therefore, that your conformity, Saturn, to the requirement is met in the measure of your physical strength. Obviously, if the outer instrument is failing, you know, and I have experience with this, you know, being almost 80 here, you just can't hold up on the physical plane what you used to be able to do. But okay, DK has an answer for that. He talked to a bedridden person. I'm not there yet, but okay. A bedridden person, and he said, look, I know you suffer over your condition, I'm paraphrasing here, but you, from your condition, can work with equal strength compared to those who have much more flexibility, mobility, outer strength. So it was encouragement. I've never seen Master DK present anything that could be ultimately considered discouraging. He may be very direct, but it's meant as an encouragement. And I hope that as you read and identify with the various disciples, that you feel that encouragement as I do in my better moments. So anyway, see to it, therefore, that your conformity to the requirement is met in the measure of your physical strength, and bearing ever in mind, and this is a good one, that you are equal to more effort and to greater strain than ever before. Well, he's a nice second-rate master, but he's not calling for an easy life. You know, I think in his work had so much devotion. There's this story about his zeal, which is over the top. Even so, that he ran into a doorway, they say, and smashed his nose. I don't know, but a zealous, zealous master, yet on the great second ray. And he has said to Roberto Assagioli, the second ray gives you the will, or like tempered steel. Well, okay, first ray mind, yes, but the second ray is giving you a will like tempered steel, means you subject the instrument to the hot and to the cold, and you function appropriately in either situation. So if the master says, I feel the zeal rising, I have to be careful. Bear in mind that you are equal to more effort and to greater strain than ever before. What kind of reaction or response is it eliciting from us? Do we want peacefulness in the lower sense of the word? Or are we willing to go along with the suggestions of Master DK? So let's make sure that you are seeing what I'm supposed to be reading here. Okay. This experiment, he says, which I have instituted, that means, of course, to start, and to which you have voluntarily and willingly submitted yourselves, is one undertaken for group purposes. Now, okay, let's just say he did not, as in the War of 1812, come alongside an American ship and take the sailors and impress them into service, meaning force them. There is no force. There is strong suggestion. But the will of the people who will form part of this experiment is voluntarily pursued, willingly pursued. And it's not just so that you can achieve individually. That will happen, of course, but it's a secondary thing, right? So always we have to remember that. We, in his eyes, we count in terms of our effect upon the group which he is trying to mold into shape. And quite a few groups at first, the 10 groups of 9, and, well, actually, the last group of 27. He never got to the completion of it. Many circumstances did intervene, and they had a lot to do with the impending war, which some call Armageddon, while others look forward to some other kind of Armageddon. So he goes on. The hierarchy seeks to discover how sensitive groups are, as a whole, to subjective guidance and instruction. Okay, they're experimenting. They don't know yet how we will respond. Interesting, they have to see how it works out, and going on, and how free the channels of communication are between the various individuals in the group and the master. Let me pause there to say, he said, well, some of you know how to reach me, and others of you know, but you don't know you know. So, and others of you need to learn. So the question is, to what extent are the gathered chelas really being guided by the master? And without distortion, because it's so easy to think you hear the master's voice, and it's just one of the astral plane voices, or it's a thought form voice giving, which always amuses me, a good words of mediocre cheer. The attaboy, attagirl attitude, no, that's not how he operates. So anyway, he says they're trying to find out how free the channels of communication are between the various individuals in the group and the master, and between the various groups within the ashram of a master. And right there, if I may say, is the cause of something that Master DK and the other masters deplore, and that is the competition and oftentimes criticism or even ill will between groups that are working for the same ashram. And I can take it further when we think of the big ashram with Madame Rurik, for all the good she has done, suspecting Alice Bailey of communicating with some master of materialism and not even realizing she had the very master with whom Alice was communicating, right in her, in a photograph in her museum. So it's a big job that Christ is facing, because there are so many opportunities to jump to the wrong conclusions or to be somehow misguided. Okay. How sensitive are the groups to the inner guidance, the inner subjective guidance and instruction? And are the channels of communication between the individuals in the group and the master really clear and not full of distortion? How will we know? Well, we have to experiment, just the way they've experimented. So DK goes on. A master's group of disciples upon the inner side of life, and let me add, a much bigger inner group than outer group. That is a truism by now, right? So a group of disciples upon the inner side of life forms an integrated organism, characterized by what? Mutual life, which is the shared essence, love, on the second ray, and that kind of third ray interplay, where there's a kind of a Geminian mutual response and interaction and response. So we're trying to form something, join that integrated organism on the inner side. And if we make the mistake of thinking that the disciples we know are the whole thing, we're leaving out a great percentage of the inner workers. That's why DK said, look, some have passed on, some you knew. Don't treat them as if they're gone. Treat them as if they are active co-workers with you. So DK goes on, the relationships, the relationships in such a group are entirely on mental and astral levels. Okay. And hence the limitations of the etheric force body and of the physical brain are not felt. Now that's a great liberation, isn't it, as they enter into that light wherein consciousness awakens into a higher form of light, I'll just put it that way, that's in our triangles of meditation. We are limited and we don't know we are limited. We adulate the physical brain, how wonderful it is, and it is a wondrous thing, but a limitation, which we will only appreciate as a limitation once we begin to have the experience of life beyond the physical brain. Let me say, I tried to explain to a dear friend of mine, look, when I'm out of the body, my brain is simply an anchor. It's not very active. It just holds a point of return, and I can think away from the brain. Well, you know, right away, that's for the scientific types, that's a big heresy. How can you think without a brain? But we have materialized the idea so much that we think we need the physical brain in order to think, and we don't. There is great thought going on through certain beings that do not have a physical brain or some kind of representative of that kind of anchor. And until we begin to experiment and say, yeah, I can think, and I'm not using my physical brain, then it's all just going to be a bunch of words to us until we can have the experience, and probably words that will be rejected. I often think that we waste a lot of time in rejecting very good offerings. And we say, well, such things are impossible, and we don't pursue them further. And as a result, we slow ourselves down, and we slow down everybody else that we might help. Needless to say, DK goes on to say, the fundamental relation is on soul levels, and let me add, above. He goes on to say, the fact that the etheric body and the physical brain lie outside these basic relations, where the ashram is concerned, leads to greater facility in understanding and reciprocal interplay. Well, this is another way of saying that the inner ashram, without the burden of the etheric physical brain, has much greater understanding and interplay of a productive kind than we can have when burdened by that concretion we call the physical brain, and the result of it, the concrete mind. I'm not saying that the brain creates the concrete mind, but when there is a physical brain, the concrete mind is empowered and seems to represent reality. So Master DK goes on, it is wise to remember, however, that the astral potency is far more strongly felt on the physical plane than elsewhere, and hence the major emphasis laid upon emotional desire control in all treatises on discipleship or on preparation for that stage. So something about the astral conditioning and its potency is really strongly felt on the physical plane. It's as if these two, in a way, are the irrational part of man. Once we reach the mind, we enter the rational part of man. But we are so often swept into a condition where the irrational part seems to be the real part. So we do have in the teaching a major emphasis laid upon emotional desire control. If we're letting our desires run away with us, we're going to have an out-of-alignment experience on the dense physical plane and even on the etheric plane, which is to be considered physical in a certain sense. Now, here he's going to speak to us again, because we are the average beginner on the path of discipleship. You know, mental pride is found in those who are the beginners, and the further you go, the less you know. It is not easy, he says, for the average beginner on the path of discipleship to grasp this, or to see the necessity for the rules and suggestions made. I mean, that the emotional desire control, let us say, is really, really needed if we're going to make progress, or our groups are going to make progress on the path of discipleship. So, following DK's advice, let us pretty much call ourselves the average beginner in all humility. So it is not easy for the average beginner on the path of discipleship to grasp this, the effect of the astral on the physical, that is, or to see the necessity for rules and suggestions made. Well, that's a big thing. You know, at first you might accept the rules and say, well, here are the rules, but they tend to grind on and to rub some people the wrong way. Why do I have to follow these things? I'm getting tired of this tedious following of the rules laid down by the master, some might say. For some people, DK says, to conform to rule and discipline is not easy, unless it is entirely self-initiated. Well, who would those people be, you know? Kind of first-rate types and strongly affected by Leo, which is the sign in many ways of self-determination. DK goes on. The suggestions, he says, which I make to you, my brothers, and let me say, whether men or women, he addresses them as my brothers, go on, are only suggestions. But it is surely the part of wisdom to follow them as long as you have voluntarily put yourselves under my tuition. It's like, you know, we would say, yes, master, you're my teacher, but then he offers his guidance and his suggestions and we don't follow it. And along the way, of those some 50 or 51 ingathered disciples, there were many who just didn't do what he said. Now, we might say to ourselves, oh, but I would have followed every word scrupulously and applied every word. But you never know, because the pressure was great, and we always knew the DK was looking in and seeing, well, not making a big deal out of it, but seeing whether we did the work or didn't. And DK said, basically, you will know who you are. If you've done the work, you will know who you are. If you have not done the work, you will know who you are. Now, so often he's repeating this issue. You know, and maybe Master Moria would, on the first ray, handle it differently, but DK says, you are subjected to no compulsion. Nobody's forcing you. This is accepted voluntarily and willingly, and you did make the choice to accept. And he might say, and I cannot accept you unless you accept my tutelage, my tuition. Sometimes the word tuition means how much you pay for college or something, but this is different. Tuition means the program of teaching. Now he's talking about how you've entered under free will and choice. And you've said, yes, yes, I will work under this master. And then how foolish it would be just to say, well, I don't want to do my homework this month. It would, you know, slow the whole group down. And it's not so inconceivable, because, as I say, time wears on and people do get tired, in some cases, of the same old thing. Now, when you're presented with the same words, the same sequence, you can make it other than the same old thing. It doesn't have to be just a repetition of the concrete mind. You can always see something new. Anyway, he's looking at the kinds of disciples that there are from his experience. They've joined because of free will and free choice. They are subjected to no compulsion. Some among those who join, conformity to rule and discipline has to be self-derived. It's a very Leo thing. I subject myself to the discipline. I don't need the master to do that for me. I'll do it myself. Fine, except we don't see everything that the master sees. So anyway, other types of disciples evince willingness to follow instructions, but their real difficulty consists in bringing the life into conformity with the desired rhythms. Now, it really helps if we can know where we are in any cycle and where we are in a combination of interlocking cycles. So, DK tells us about the narrow path. The narrow path, which all disciples have to tread, all disciples, requires obedience to the ancient rules for disciples. Now, right there, you get into trouble with occult obedience and the dislike of occult obedience rendered by the average contrary personality. So there are ancient rules. Master DK is able to dig them up for us from the Shambolic libraries. We don't have a library card yet, okay? And he's there to make them available to us in the measure that they can help us. Now, the ancient rules, obedience to the ancient rules for disciples. This is given willingly and with eyes open, though no rigid adherence to such rules is ever expected. Well, it's not like one size fits all. The general idea is given by the rule, but you make your own adaptation. I was talking with a very close friend, and the friend said, okay, I'm going to go out and I need some white wine. Okay, well, let's not be fanatic. And I said, maybe somewhat fanatically, read Rule 6. Where? Rule 6 in Initiation and Human and Solar. And you may not find yourself going out to buy the white wine, which otherwise you might use as simply a relaxant and so forth. It's just so specific about fermented liquors and so forth. Well, was I wrong to mention it? I was certainly not for a moment there in good graces. The individual said to me, you don't need to lecture me. Well, that's my problem sometimes. I'm a little bit hectoring and sometimes say the unpleasant thing, even if I myself, maybe especially if I myself, would have difficulty carrying it out. In this particular case, no. The disciple, says the Tibetan, grows through intelligently adapting his life, let me say, through third-ray methods, intelligently adapting his life to these requirements as far as is reasonably possible, and let me add, without being a total fanatic and distressing the people that are around you, The disciple grows through intelligently adapting his life to these requirements as far as is reasonably possible, let me say, because we are enjoined to use our reason with accuracy and not just say, oh, the mind, it's a low thing with its reasoning, I'm not going to bother with it. Intuition will tell me what is true. Well, maybe it will, but maybe your mind might reveal to you when you are simply fooling yourself. And of course, that's quite a discovery for any of us. So anyway, the disciple grows through intelligently adapting his life to these requirements. Well, what is a requirement? You know, pretty much saying you cannot achieve the state you want unless you fulfill certain requirements, certain things that must be done, and if they're not done, it doesn't happen for you. Until you wake up and you find a way to make it happen for you, and then you probably look at it closely and see, well, if I had tried to fulfill the requirement or requirements in the beginning, the whole arrival process would have been much smoother. So here we are adapting to these requirements, but within reason, so as not to be what DK calls the unintelligent fanatic. DK says, we don't waste our time, I'm paraphrasing, keeping the company of unintelligent fanatics. And we progress, he goes on to say, not by adapting the requirements to his life. It's quite the opposite. It's adapting the life to the requirements. Going on, flexibility within certain limits is always needed. And that's where the rigidity of the concrete mind can be such a barrier, because flexibility is always needed, but that flexibility must not be set in motion by any personality inertia or mental questioning. I had an experience the other night. Well, we have two beautiful cats, and they love to escape without their identification, which is very dangerous. And one of them, who is normally such a sweet, wonderful cat, pulled an escape act. And there I am struggling with this, because sometimes my breathing makes it difficult to get to the top of the stairs. And I said, okay, the cat has escaped. I don't know whether the cat is waiting for someone to let him in, or where is he? And I struggled with myself. I struggled with personality inertia. There I was. I could have tried to go back to sleep, such as sleep was. I could have said, is it really worth it? The cat will be back in the morning. Oh, so after all that, about 3:30 in the middle of the night, I overcame personality inertia. And I said, regardless of how difficult it is to get back up the stairs, I'm going down. And to my disappointment, as I went down and checked outside, there was just no cat. and all the places that I thought that cat might be, it just wasn't, and I could barely walk to take care of that. So what I did, I'll tell you in just a moment. Well, where was I? I was being reminded that you have to eat to live. I've kind of lost my appetite for many things, but the point is I decided, hey, I'm going down. And to my disappointment, just no cat. No matter what door I tried or calling out the name of the cat and hoping for the best. But, okay, I had overcome personality inertia. And of course I struggled on the way coming back up the stairs, which is no fun, believe me, having to kind of stop at the midway point and just make sure that there's enough steam to get to the top. So let's just say we can be flexible, and we can't let our personality promptings determine our action, because from the personality angle, I would just like to try to get back to sleep at 3:30 in the morning instead of spending an hour looking for the escaped cat. So through little things, you discover whether personality inertia has seized you, and all kinds of cogitation, mental questioning, and so forth, or whether you've been able to overcome a little bit of that, and I only say a little bit. Now, actually, I am being called away, and I'm hoping that this is a program of about an hour, and maybe a little less than an hour. So, no matter where I am here, I do have to stop right now, and we'll be, when I next can do it, beginning program 12, Discipleship in the New Age, section 1. Or volume 1, rather, section 1, still with part 3, video commentary, and what we've done up till now is just move a few pages, and I've told you the story of the personality and the cat. You know, you live with the guilt of possibly that beautiful, wonderful, lovely, loving cat disappearing because it has no identification, whether the foxes get it or the eagles get it or gets hit by a car or whatever, or whether you drag yourself into doing the right thing or drag your not self and then starting knowing that you're either satisfied or dissatisfied, you will have to start up the stairs one more time. So we'll continue here as much as possible, and I'm wishing you all and to you with me and all the members of the communications team of BL and Michael Stacy and Joe Waltz and Michael Crow and others, wishing you lots of love and many blessings as you absorb with all seriousness the wonderful words of the Tibetan and hopefully a few words of mine which may expand and deepen the field of knowledge. Okay, coming back then later to all this. We'll see you soon.